Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Hello, everybody. It's so great to see you. And welcome. Thanks for joining on a Saturday in all your spare screen time during the pandemic. It's so amazing. I'm just smiling really wide, just seeing all of you on my screen and the spirit that we're all gathered here for. We have an exciting call lined up. Partly we're excited because we don't really know what's going to happen. But at the same time, we know that the kind of lineage of journeys that have convened here is something that's just really exciting and beautiful to witness. And so the kind of intention for this call, as you read in the invite, is really just an opportunity to hear a little bit more of some of the experiences of some of the volunteers in our Laddership Circle. So I think almost all of us are partaking in a Laddership Circle this spring. And, you know, as you know, in these circles, the volunteers are always asking the questions and holding the questions. But they've got some incredible experiences of their own. And Lucas, who's at least on my screen, he's in the top left corner. he said, you know, it'd be really great to hear about some of the journeys of some of the volunteers in the circle, you know, and I'm doing my own gift experiments and I'd really like to just hear a little bit more about what others have done or what others have been kind of exploring or what challenges they've encountered or what kind of were those core moments for them that really propelled them forward. And we thought, wow, that's, you know, that's true. That'd be great for all of us. So we thought, let's just invite everyone and to this conversation and see what wants to surface from there. So that's kind of how this call came together. The way that it'll flow, I think, is we'll do a quick round of check-ins just to hear from everybody. And it'll just be around this question of, you know, just say your name. It'll be short. It won't be like our circle of sharing on the calls, but it'll just be say your name and maybe what's a question you're holding on your service journey or, you know, in your gift experiments or, you know, in leading with inner transformation, just what's one question that you might be holding around that. And just so we can get everyone's voices in, and then we'll have about, we'll spend maybe half hour or so in a kind of fishbowl inspired dialogue with our circle anchors and hearing a bit of their journey. And then we'll probably spend 20, 30 minutes after that hearing from actually everyone else. I think we wanted to, if you've ever done a fishbowl, it's like there's one inner circle and one outer circle. So the inner circle dialogues and then the outer circle listens. And then when the inner circle is finished, the outer circle shares reflections or questions, or they reflect and the inner circle listens. So that's when it's in person. Right now we're all in grids, so we'll just pretend that there's circles. and we'll have, you know, the circle volunteers kind of dialogue around some questions that Lucas will pose. And then after that, everyone will have a chance to either ask questions or just kind of reflect amongst themselves. Because really, although we have circle volunteers and we have circle participants, we all kind of meld as one also and go back and forth. And we're all kind of converging here because we hold similar questions of, you know, how do you really lead with love in the world? And how do you experiment in a gift economy? And how do you, you know, how do I deepen in my service journey? So with that, I wanted to hand it off to Lucas to maybe just share a little bit about the intention behind this call before we jump into a round of the check-ins on a question you're holding. And Lucas is calling in from France. Usually he's calling in front of this beautiful tree, but maybe it's a rainy day. We're always...
It's sunny.
Yeah, it actually looks like a sunny day. But maybe he needs to be more focused today.
I wanted this big screen to see all these people. This is so wonderful, you know, and on my big screen. It's so good. Do you hear me well?
Yes.
Because sometimes it doesn't work. Okay, cool. So I'm a little too excited, like I drank not one coffee, but five. seeing, you know, the result of our the conversation with Audrey is a little, I feel a little difficult and not comfortable, a little too fast. But what is usually for me most exciting, not only exciting, helping me on journeys to discover is when people with experience speak of their experience. There's something happening like a transmission. So this is even happening when I read these articles, especially when they're written in a certain way. But here we have people already which made their path from the inner to the outer concerning gift economy. I mean, we all make paths from inner to outer, isn't it? But here are some which applied actually what we are learning. So I would really be happy if we have the opportunity to hear from you more about that. That's it. Yeah. I mean, that's the intent. The intention is to learn.
That's great. Yeah, it's beautiful. And Lucas, yeah. And I wrote a little bit about Lucas in our email, but he's, you know, he's actually been a musician for 20 years and an entrepreneur for 15 years and then a meditator and Buddhist practitioner for over 30 years. So he brings a wealth of experience in one of his current labor of loves, which I think he and Eric, who's on this call, are envisioning is kind of creating a platform around, you know, just fostering learning that helps realize our interconnections. And so he's holding a lot of questions around, how do I do this in a way that really aligns with values, in a way that really leads with love, and in a concrete way, you know, just in practice, what does that look like? So thank you, Lucas, for inspiring all of us to come together to learn from each other. And maybe what we'll do now is just have a short round of just to hear from everyone around what's your name and what's a question that you're holding related to service, related to designing for gift or for transformation. I'll put it in the chat window if it's helpful to visualize the question. And maybe what we'll do is if one of you feels brave and inspired to raise your hand and go first, you can do that. And then we'll go in alphabetical order from there. And we'll probably skip the volunteers of the circle since we'll hear from the volunteers a little bit later.
Yeah. Just to say, we thought of this just like 1-3 sentences, just so that everyone is welcomed in the circle and we have a kind of vision who in the world we are talking to, you know, just a very brief.
Awesome. So Coleman is ready to go. And after Coleman, I think is David, because David is always after Coleman.
I'm the engineer, so I want to get things kick off and get it moving. So I am Coleman Fung, greetings from Austin, Texas. I am very interested in ways in which we can actually apply gift ecology, put it into action. So that's why I'm here.
Great. We'll go to David, and after David is Eric.
Yeah, hi everybody. I'm David Bonbright. I'm calling in today from London, where I live. It's a beautiful day. Question. Actually, I'll stay on theme. I am so taken by, not even begin to have the language for, the volunteers in the service-based community. So when Audrey advertised an opportunity to hear some of your journeys, I jumped on it. And I suppose the question behind that answer is, how can I be more like you?
Oh, thank you, David. That's very sweet. And David has, you know, seen a lot in his journey as well. So we hope to hear from you later. Eric, and then Hollister. Eric might have to unmute himself. Yeah.
Hi, everybody. I'm talking from France. I'm really kind of discovering the leadership circles, although I have a long journey with the theory of gift economy. So I'm really eager to learn and understand how we can apply it now in a concrete through concrete. Initiatives. Okay, so that's why I'm here. Okay,
great. Thank you, Eric. Welcome. over to Hollister and then to Jasky.
Hi, everybody. I had my camera off because I was pounding my breakfast really quick. I didn't want to be rude. I'm calling in from Florida, South Florida. It's a really hot, humid, rainforesty kind of day. I think I'm in a ton of questions specific to this space today. I guess it's I like to listen, as a couple of people have mentioned, and be inspired by others to help me more deeply consider, I guess, what my role is. So I'm just really listening in for what is my specific niche in this exploration, and how that will be translated into whatever service that looks like in the world.
Thank you, Hollister. We'll go to Jasky and then Joe.
Hello, everyone. I'm Jasky from France, Paris. Mm-hmm. So the question I'm holding is a question that Prerag raised, is how can I discern between laziness and the do-nothing approach? Because I'm kind of lazy person, and yeah, I don't know how to do it.
Thank you, Jasky. We're all laughing because we know you're the opposite of lazy. But that is a beautiful question, one I ask myself a lot too. So thank you for presencing that. We'll go to Joe and then Olivier.
Hi, greetings from Ventura, California. It's on the coast of Southern California. And my question is, I'm being pulled in a direction that just seems contrary to going into service, and I'm just trying to feel into whether or not that really is drawing me on my path, or if it's taking me off my path. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you, Joe. Olivier, and then Patrick.
Hey, everyone. It's Olivier from France, Paris, or somewhere in France. Grateful to be here, having other leaders with us. And currently I'm in this leadership to really dig into myself and go as deep as I can. And not longer than 1 hour ago, we had a good discussion with Jessica and Patrick. And the question that I'm holding now is, why am I in this service approach today? And how can I relate it to my dreams of my childhood? So what were my childhood dreams? And how can I, because when I was a children, I wanted to serve. And so what part of the childhood did I keep today so that I could use it to serve more myself and around me?
Thank you, Olivier. Patrick, and after Patrick is Sally Ann.
Okay, so hello everyone. I'm glad to be here. In fact, I'm just in the beginning of my path to service, so I'm here really to listen to you guys. And every day, maybe I'm asking myself, how can I find the strength every day and be inspired to continue on this path of service? So thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. He's also on the French, in the French gang. go to Salian and then Afsha.
Yeah, I'm Salian and I'm calling in from sunny London, like David. lovely to be here. I just love seeing everybody's smiling faces. So that's number one why I'm here. Number two is because I really want to listen and learn from everybody's practical experiences, echoing what so many have said. David, you know, the volunteers are just a shining example from the moment I entered service space. On a practical level, I'm really interested, as Coleman says, in how we can practically implement the ideas of service space and the gift ecology into our own projects, particularly within a market economy, and what, if any, does the role of money play within that structure? Thank you.
Great question. And Sally Ann is our featured guest on Wednesday's breakout, so we'll get to hear more then too. One of our featured guests. Over to Asha and then Alan.
Good morning, everyone from LA. I don't yet know if it's sunny. It probably is because my blinds are still closed. But it probably is. So the question that I'm holding related to gift quality on my service journey. So the reason I'm on this call is because I'm currently in a circle and I'm getting so much out of it. And I guess I just want to learn more because I really hope that I'm not only in this while I'm during the circle. I want to take everything I'm learning during the circle and make it a part of my greater reality in my long-term life. So I feel like attending circles like this and hearing from experienced people who've been doing it for years, I want to learn a lot from it. So that's what I'm hoping to get out of it. So thank you.
Thank you, Asha. And thanks for joining us in the middle of Ramadan. She's been staying up late to break her fast and still joining us on an early morning call. So Ashima is next. And then I think that's it. So Ashima can close it off for us.
You said Alan.
Oh, no, Alan. Sorry, Alan.
Hello, everyone. Great to be with you. Calling in today from Santa Cruz, California. Really enjoying the laddership circle that I'm in, starting to think of it as like a fermentation, an inner fermentation where I don't know how it'll turn out, but I've got what I bring to it and the healthy bacteria of all the knowledge and wisdom of the anchors and Audrey. So grateful for that. I'd say question I'm holding so many, but one that I'll share now is when looking at measuring impact of like doing good, how much should I look inwards versus outwards?
That's a great question. If you find the answer, let us know. We'll go to Ashima to close out this part and then we'll hear from the others who have not yet spoken.
Hello, everybody. My name is Ashima, and I am currently in India, in Rajasthan. And I'm so happy to see familiar and newer faces, like all the smiles, like Sally Ann was saying. And so when Audrey sent the invite, I was like, yes, 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 I've been missing leadership so much anyway. One question that I'm holding currently is, like what Alan was saying, inside or outside. So something which turned up during this quarantine and lockdown period was like there's a lot of physical activity outside. And in that, it was easy to lose sight of what nourishes me from inside. It was easy to get consumed by that so much that it was easy to lose sight. And I have recently been thinking that what is it that nourishes me? How do I protect it? How do I be aware of it? How do I be mindful of it and practice it? So that's something that I'm holding.
Great. Thank you, Ashima. We have your, at least on my screen, your face is frozen in a very thoughtful, oh no, now you're not. You were frozen in a very
thoughtful. Okay, I don't know where you lost me.
No, we heard you, just visually. Okay. It was frozen in a very like inquisitive looking face. So, but now you're back, so visually, we could hear you the whole time. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for getting us started in that way. I think it's a beautiful thing as we all kind of have been experiencing. There's a lot of questions around this topic that we've been holding. And I think one of the things I am always reminded of is that, you know, it's inner transformation is not a copy paste type of model or a model that you can replicate. And so there's so much richness in just coming together in such ways and in from our different contexts and seeing what seeds might be ripe to bloom in our different fields and individually and collectively. So with that, I think we'll head over to our fishbowl experiment. And so we wanted to invite Jane and Parag and Bill and Colin and Bijan. Bijan, we're kind of putting him on the spot a little bit, but he's cool to roll with it, I think. yes, because his kids are out, so he can focus. But we wanted to invite you guys who are all volunteering, some of our volunteers in the different circles right now, and to just have a fishbowl. So I think Lucas will pose a couple questions, but really I think we wanted to just hear a bit of, you know, what were those moments of, you know, where maybe you pivoted along your journey, or what where you might have gained some clarity to move forward in a service-hearted way, or in a way that aligns with values, and what kinds of learnings have you come across along your diverse experiments? I think I've written about them. We kind of know a bit about them. Maybe I'll introduce them a little bit as they share, so I don't talk for a long time. But with that, we'll spend probably the next half hour or so on that part, and then we'll kind of get open it up and hear from the rest of our crew here. So Lucas, did you want to share the questions for our volunteers or anything else?
Yeah, I think it was that already you pointed it out. The question we in our discussion we met has been what has been most encouraging and empowering you in applying gift economy from inside out, and on the opposite was what have been the most dangerous moments. And how could you balance or transform them? These are the two, and then there was a third one which came up to me today and yesterday and now even again. It's the whole idea of, so how does money work in your system? That's maybe the third one. Maybe another round then in the inner circle. So the first one is more about the what encouraged and empowered you, what worked, what in the positive way, what was the dangerous part, and how did you work with it? And it's all about application. I think that's really what we are interested in.
Great. Thank you. So I just put that in the chat window. And we just wanted to give space for you to reflect on that. And I think while you're chewing on it, I might pick on Jane to maybe share first, because Jane, you've had kind of pretty remarkable journey from corporate law to specialized in venture capital. So you're very familiar and versed in money and policy. and you know, you're headquartered in the UK and Ireland and New York, so you have experiences with these different cultures, but somewhere along the way you decided to pivot from that whole world to start a labor of love startup called Peace Beam, literally to like beam well wishes, you know, to the world. And 250,000 people at least have heard her voice, or her voice has been heard at least that many times through Insight Timer, through the time meditations that they offer. But at the same time, you're also experimenting around, you know, how do you offer something with multiple forms of capital, maybe engage, inspire people to do acts of kindness and in exchange for an audiobook, or, you know, things like that. So could you share a bit about, you know, your response to these questions? Was there a turning point for you, and kind of what have you been learning from your experiments?
Yeah, of course. And it's lovely to, I'm actually really curious about everybody's journey as well. So this is a really great idea, I think. It's a funny thing about being a volunteer that we don't, we know huge amounts about each other, but actually very little about the kind of practical day to day. It's kind of an odd thing that occurs. So I am a lawyer by profession, and I was I ran a venture capital fund for about 15 years until 2015. And I was kind of found myself about 35 on. I'm 50 now, so about, yeah, in early 30s, where I had developed a kind of an in very uncomfortable internal landscape, because what I did in the world in no way matched my kind of emerging interior world. So, you know, I was in this kind of corporate environment, very, very cutthroat, very savage, very profit motivated. And in my, that didn't match my interior world anyway, but I was also going through a process of sort of the beginnings of what became essential to my life, which is that sort of inner journey. And during the course of my sort of 30s and into my late 30s, that just became more and more intense for me, where the collision of those two worlds was costing me a great deal. Personally, it was costing me in terms of my relationships, in terms, I would say, of my physical health and certainly my mental health. I think that schism between those two things. And yes, I couldn't see a way of operating outside of my familiar world, my familiar landscape. I had, you know, I'd done a lot of training. I'd gone in my 20s through a process of acquiring a lot of qualifications and degrees and all of that kind of stuff. And you're always faced with that question. Well, I've ticked all the boxes. I've done all of the things that you said I was supposed to do in order to be, you know, happy or content in my life. And I was becoming increasingly unhappy, I think, and discontented. And as that interior journey sort of grew, I just found that I was really struggling to continue to keep up the facade that was required to do my job. And I was, you know, very good at my job. And it was also an exciting world, I have to say. You know, I mean, it was, you know, there were lots of deals being done and it was very, it was interesting, and there was a kind of a glamour to it, which I was very attracted to do. And that was one of the things that I found hardest to give up, actually. And then there were a series of, you know, very dramatic events in my life around kind of 2014, 2015. And it was one of those moments where, you know, you're at a massive crossroads in your life, like a decision has to be made of whether you follow your heart, like go with your heart, or you shave or reform yourself to fit back into a world that you had outgrown. And so I chose the former, really not through any sense of nobility, but because I knew I wouldn't survive if I knew some part of myself was dying, really. Mm-hmm. So that was a kind of a major moment when I came to the decision to do something different, and Peace Beam came out of that as a startup, and there were lots of different iterations of it at the beginning. And then my question was, how do I do this without falling back into the patterns and the ways of being that I was very schooled in? And I think the most empowering experience that I had in those early days of the company was coming across service space. And I'm not just saying that because we're on a service space call this afternoon, but it really was, because I had no language, I had no map, I didn't understand the territory either of how you actually translate those kind of the desires of your interior world into something that actually might work in the physical world. And so I acquired, I think, an understanding and a language. And I think the most empowering moment for me was realizing that I did not have to know what the answer or the solution was to everything. Actually, learning the skill of holding questions and dropping into that space of emergence was the richest field, the soil that you could grow something in. And I think that that was a major turning point for me in feeling that I could actually do something with Peace Beam where I could mine the world of gift ecology, the kind of expression that I wanted to have in the world, and also use, you know, my background and my experience for the kind of practicality of how you might bed that in. How do you make a company like that sustainable? And I think that, you know, one of your questions is, what's been the most dangerous moment in the journey? And the dangerous moments are always, in my experience, is where you come up against the edge between market economy practicality and that kind of the desire to express something that is outside the norm. And that happens pretty much all the time. And I think that has to be a constant, it's an exercise of of that muscle of being willing to hold the question, being willing to be in that space of emergence, and also being willing to apply practicality to that as well. So in order for us to include, or actually to lead really with a kind of a gift ecology, and we do that through, we're at the moment in the middle of kind of a long experiment with kindness capital, so that we accept kindness capital in the same way that we would accept money, so it, as a currency. And we're researching and doing, you know, quite a lot of data gathering on that. But in order for us to do that, we needed some funding. We made a decision that we wouldn't take external funding, but we did need something to come in. And so we were approached by the London School of Economics to do some work with them around entrepreneurship. They have an accelerator and that kind of thing. And so we did that as paid work because they're a university and they wanted the work for the accelerator, and that has funded the other stuff that we can do. And hopefully that relationship will continue. They're about to launch that audiobook in a couple of weeks' time, and they're speaking to us about producing other work. So that, from a practical point of view, was how I was able to keep that space of holding the question open. And how does money work in your system? I guess I just answered that really with the... So that's a very kind of potted... I don't want to keep speaking for too long because there's so many of us to get through. So I hope I answered some of your questions at least, Lucas. I have more questions than you have, I think. So no, I don't know if any of that was helpful.
That was so great. Yeah, thank you so much, Jane. I feel like I have 10 more questions after hearing you share, but... I think I'm breaking the laws of the fishbowl by chiming in here. So do any other of the circle anchors feel moved to reflect on anything Jane has shared or any of your own experiences with this question? Colin.
I was just going to say to applaud you. You so gracefully sort of hit the nail on the head with the questions that were posed. So thank you for giving us a little bit of insight, particularly on the question of capital and how does that interplay in economy. And I love the notion of, the danger being the edge between the aspiration of the internal and then the perceived practicality of the external. So I think that's a really excellent one to think about.
Nowadays you just you're hit by that kind of, oh god, this is like, why don't I just do what everybody else is doing and make it easier? And that, like, I mean, that's just a constant edge for me.
I think in some respects I find that the reason to hold out is because we are on not just a journey, but this is an expedition of discovery. And if we go easy, then we don't learn. We can't discover anymore. We just go back to where everyone else is. And so it's that expeditioner's mindset of like, I have to uncover what is beyond that unknown. I think that kind of holds us where we are.
Yeah, and having, other people who have the same aims and, that like-heartedness is just, that was, it's such an enormous relief to me to, and to participate in circles like this and being part of Laddership and continuing to be, making sure that you're surrounded by noble friends. It's really crucial, I think, because there are dark days, right? So.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I think I might jump in and break the rules of the fishbowl again. but I might invite, I think, Parag, if I might pick on you, which I know you're cool with. But many of you, I think, have met Parag in India while he was serving for some retreats. But in a way, I think you span a wide spectrum from running a 2,500 person company to founding a school for 1,500 students. And then to serving as an invisible volunteer. You know, you were up at odd hours picking up people for some of the retreats that we've been part of, you know, organizing rides, doing people's dishes. And anyone who goes to your city, Parag lives in Surat in India, anyone who goes there can see how anything that you organize is fueled by this army of giftivists. And it's mind-blowing, really. And I think it's been about 7 years of community building there, that where you've kind of been growing these awaken circles. You've been running Karma Kitchen, a pay it forward restaurant. You've been engaging, I think you've had circles around parenting and around, you know, just the community, the way that everyone has been experimenting there. You're doing a 21-day kindness lockdown challenge, kindness to family during lockdown challenge now. So from your lens, from the wide range of experiences that you've had, what would you say is kind of critical in building compassionate communities or implementing labor of love kind of initiatives, or anything else that strikes you to speak on?
Thank you. It feels great to be here. So many familiar faces and so many new faces too. So nice to meet you, all of you. I think I would share one experience of gift economy, and I would use the word ecology. It looks more appropriate to me. When I attended a retreat in Ahmedabad, and it was out of nowhere, you know, just something happened and, you know, some dots get connected, and I was invited for a retreat in Ahmedabad. And to be honest, when I reached Ahmedabad, even I didn't know the address. I have to call 4 times even to reach at the venue, not knowing anyone, nothing, just one person, and I was there. And I stayed, that was in 2012 December. And, you know, it was a 4-day retreat. And, you know, I had a deep, deep, deep experience of what it means to be in community, what it means to serve, and what it means to lead by love, and the power of community. And since then, I think that glimpse was so powerful enough that I have not looked back. I am deeply connected with the community. I just go and serve wherever I have the opportunity. So that's the background. And I think the key to really implement a labor of love project, I think it lies in a community. So how do you cultivate a field? I think that's so much important for anything to flourish. Creating a field, and to create that field, I think you have to lead with change and really start thinking, you know, you have to start small service projects and see where it leads to. Per se, there are not any cut-paste formula here, but I think deep relationship, you know, with people through small act, random act of kindness or service or any small project, or till the community was not there, connected with community across the globe, I think are the, you know, is the key ground, is the field where, you know, you can implement anything. You know, it cannot be just a design of an individual mind to implement a labor of love project. You need the context, and context is the field. And I think that has to be in first place, be in place to implement anything. When you are connected in good deeds, you know, so many things emerge and you learn so many things even without your knowing. In community, you know, Surat has a very vibrant community. We have Awakening Circles. We host so many other events, you know, Karma Kitchen, Awakening Circle for Kids. You know, we had leadership retreat, you know, for leadership alumni last December in Surat. So, you know, we are quite a few events across the year. But the power of community is so vivid and so apparent that so many things get accomplished when people just come together and lead with love. I think so key element to me is the field, which is the field of law and business community. Probably what has been the most dangerous moment and what was so crucial for it to happen, I said community. And the dangerous moment in this, in your journey, I think is laziness. Sometimes
laziness?
See, you know, what is service journey? I think whatever is in front of you, how can you serve? That sums up everything for me as a service journey. I mean, I'm listening to you. That's a service. You are listening to me. That's a service. And maybe next moment, there is another opportunity. Maybe after this call, I will have another opportunity. And the key deterrent to that is laziness. And to get, in the field of your mind, and is this possible? Is this not possible? And you still are driven by mind instead of being rooted in the field of emergence. So that's the key danger. And I think the only way to navigate is to stay connected in different service projects, stay connected with good people, in good deeds, good acts. I think that they are all micro moments of transformation for every individual. We can debate the speed, but there is an opportunity to get transformed in every moment. And probably that would be keep you rooted on the path. I think I'm done. Thank you. The third question we will answer later on when the round is over.
Thank you, Parag. I feel like I have 10 more questions for you, but in the interest of hearing from everybody, maybe we'll return, or maybe some of the others in the call might have further questions or want to follow up on any of the things mentioned. But yeah, thank you for that. And we will, I think I'm just going to forego this fishbowl thing and just call on Bill now, who has, some of you are familiar with, I think, and he's serving in one of our circles. But Bill, you have actually worked with Aravind Eye Hospital closely, and we all read about that in our readings last week or the week before. You knew Dr. V. You also started your own kind of Institute for Health and Healing, and wanted to kind of really transform. You're really interested in transforming healthcare and, you know, leading with values and kind of a holistic view of that before that became popular. I think people used to call him Dr. Ohm. But for you, you know, maybe it'd be great, since we are all familiar with Aravind Eye Hospital, it'd be great to hear maybe what's one key learning that you've received from your collaborations with Aravind or from Dr. V, or maybe what's a unique design principle that you see is critical for leading with love, since you've kind of been steeped in a lot of different organizations.
Simple, straightforward, unambiguous questions, right?
Well, surgeon could handle it.
Yeah, that's right. That makes surgery look easy. The question, even given the list and some of Lucas's kind of key questions, that has kept my attention over the last couple of days is, how in the world did I get here? And I don't really have an answer to that. And Audrey, you know, I can't say hello in less than 5 minutes. However, I've always, at least in the last maybe 30 years, recognized that if I can't kind of nail it with a word or two what I'm talking about, I probably don't really know what I'm talking about. And it's interesting to me the inner-outer dilemma, the seen part of our existence versus the unseen part of our existence. I can't really let go of those, but I definitely can put my finger exactly on when the inner transformation really happened, which has been a real gift.
And that occurred in 1983, before most of you were even born, probably, when I had the opportunity to go to Madurai in India with a dear colleague of mine who I had actually met in the late 60s. And we came together. He was an East Coaster. I was sort of a Midwesterner. We came together at the University of California, San Francisco Medical Center in the Department of General Surgery. And we both wound up in ophthalmology. In part, I would say, because of the power of the visual senses and what it meant to us. And the two of us were partners at the San Francisco General, at the Veterans Administration Hospital, at the university. And it was one of the most interesting years of my life. And it was transformative in that the my initial start in medicine happened when I was a little kid. And somebody already mentioned this, the childhood dream part. There was no question in my mind that I wanted to be a doctor. And I mean, when I was a little kid, and I mean, this was when I was 3, 4, 5 years old. And somehow that manifested along the way. And during that, all the years of training, I had the good fortune to be exposed to a many, many cities, countries, circumstances where the medical professional was not just making a living, but was serving the community in a very special way. And when you've been at the San Francisco General, the Miami General, London, Israel, Colorado, California, it was so empowering to see what was going on in the world. And in 83, I think my ego is what brought me to India to work with Aravind, but it was my soul that came home. And it never went away. So I continued my relationship with Aravind to this very day and trained people who spent time with me in San Francisco, and I spent time in India, because of that old saying, if you want to feed a person for one day, give them a fish. If you want to feed them for a lifetime, teach them how to fish. And that was the approach that we lived with. And
Bill, so can I just jump in? You said your ego led you to India to Aravind.
India to help.
And your soul came home. What happened in that, in between the ego and the soul?
Well, what I anticipated seeing there was a setting in which certainly my knowledge base they didn't have, but they were wide open to get it, to learn those techniques. And of course, I didn't appreciate until I lived in it the magnitude of what their inner world was all about. And Dr. Venkataswamy, who was a hero in India before he started the Aravind Hospital system, which is now the largest eye care system in the world. The number of cases that they do is unmatched. The quality of care is world class. And I would let any of their senior surgeons operate on me. It's that fulfilling and that real. And his principles in the workplace were really three: compassion, which is would turn nobody away; excellence, which means we have to be safe and we have to be as good as it can possibly be; and sustainability. We can't be completely dependent on philanthropy, or we're going to lose it at some point. And he had a way of turning obstacles into opportunities, which informed me in many, many ways, because when I came back, the seed had been planted for what I was hoping could be the first department of planetary medicine ever, because we're all so interconnected. What we see, what we don't see, it's all interconnected. How can we bring that forward in medicine and in healthcare so it's not just an objectified science, but it's also heartfelt? And in 1999, I gave a named lecture at the American Academy of Ophthalmology and their joint meeting with the Pan American Academies of Ophthalmology. And the title of my talk was Surgery, Service, and Soul, and which led to another named lecture, which was Medicine, Mastery, Meaning, Money, and most importantly, mystery. Alliteration, you can get the point. I have kind of a little gene for alliteration. And I think that's about the only way, without talking for probably 24 to 48 hours nonstop, that I can convey the essence of my transformation and the courage it gave me to swim upstream for a really long time. And when we began the Institute for Health and Healing in the Sutter Health System, which is a very large Northern California operation with multiple hospitals, thousands of employees, thousands of doctors, etc., it became very clear to me that I had to be able to leave my comfort zone and swim upstream. And that was, I think somebody already mentioned the potential for loneliness. Maybe Jane, it was you in the arena where you've succeeded and yet you're not fulfilled by that success. And it can be a really lonely place, but it's really worth it to be out there on the edge. As my older son told me when he was much, much younger, if you're not living at the edge, you're taking up too much space. So I hope that gives a sense of kind of where I've been and how I got there or here. But again, that's only transient. You know, that thing does, that peace doesn't last forever. Because if you're prone to do that, you wind up at the edge again, but you keep on going, just like Dr. V did.
Thank you.
And I guess that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
That's great. Thank you, Bill. We know you have a wealth of stories under your belt, so we'll look forward to trying to tease them out a little bit more. But thank you. I think many of us have been inspired by, I think, Pavi's piece on the Aravind Eye Hospital's creative constraints. And so it's very inspiring to hear about your kind of firsthand experience with them. I think I'm going to ping Bijan next, if he's cool with it. And Bijan is in Germany right now, but he actually he's lived in many different places, I think, but he used to live in California back when he was doing his PhD at UC Berkeley, and he used to go running in these hills. And there is, I think, one day, I hope it's okay that I'm sharing this story, but there is one day where he was running and he just said he just prayed for, to find a way to lead with love in a way, maybe not in those words, but to be able to, like, is it possible to run a startup, to run a business with people that believe in love and that's fueled by love? And what would that look like? And I think that was maybe 10, 15 years ago or something like that, or 8 years ago. I don't know the exact numbers, but after some time, I think we stumbled upon him last year, and he's been doing, actually now his work is super busy. It's actually really amazing because he works in disaster resiliency. And so during this pandemic, he's been so busy and volunteering in the Leadership Circle. And we get emails from him at like 3 a.m. his time. And he's homeschooling his two kids with his wife. So So it's just amazing to see the heart and the love that you bring, Bijan, to our circles, to this space, and to also your disaster resiliency work. He's created an organization and running a company on kind of, I think it's risk. Is it risk? Something with risk. I only know the disaster management one. but yeah, Bijan, any thoughts from you?
Yeah, I feel so humbled and honored to, you know, be able to share here in this circle with so many who have actually done so much. If I felt put on the spot, it's because I feel so humble compared to, you know, the story, the breadth and depth that Bill was just sharing. But connecting off of what you were saying, Audrey, that was in the Berkeley Hills, and that place was special to me because that's where I did my PhD, and we, you know, started a startup, and we did quite well with it. I got sick of that at some point, and I realized that this doesn't really speak to my inner aspirations. So I got away from the West Coast, and I went all the way to Japan, and I lived there and for a while, and I connected with sort of a spiritual path that has led me. And if there is been a design principle in my life, it's sort of that spiritual journey has led me to gain a deep trust and a relationship with mystery. As Bill, you had used that word, and that's made all the difference. That everything that unfolds for a reason, and I don't fuss so much about, you know, am I doing the right thing? There's always sort of the pragmatic things you got to do in life, but there's this deep axis of trust I feel that has led me. So that's been an important design principle, and that was 2014 when I was in the hills. I wasn't running then, but I was just going back the path where I used to train for a marathon, and I had that prayer out in the world: God, connect me with people who are all about service, right? And I came across an article by Nipun. I got connected to the Laddership Circles, and I feel what Parag is saying, this community is such an important ingredient in any labor of love project. When you can't just put yourself out there alone and say, okay, if you want to work with others, you got to have that sense of community and people who are aligned with you in that. And so this is, again, the trust is it's already happened through Laddership. I get so nourished every week when I hear everybody's journeys, and that helps me connect with people who are aligned in that way. In my own sort of NGO startup world, I have colleagues that are very dear to me, but I wouldn't say necessarily they see the world in these terms. So that's a bit of where I'm juggling with right now. We're kind of pushed a lot by these market forces because there's a company, it's called Hotel Resilient, and we've developed certification program and auditing tools for hotels to check themselves to reopen for COVID. And so it's a big topic now, and there's a lot of opportunity, and there's big market pushes. We have a meeting with Disneyland Paris, for example, Monday, but I'm not so, if that was 15 years ago, I would think of that very differently. And I think now I would look at it as a way to make sure we're sustainable and find pragmatic ways of getting this group on its path, but not forget about sort of why we came into existence in the first place. The details and mechanics of how that's going to work in terms of a gift ecology is not clear to me. But again, I think there is a trust that somehow it will come. It will come together. I just need to say yes to opportunities that feel right, and hope also that I can bring this group of people that I'm with right now on that path. I really don't know how it's going to pan out, but yeah, we're in the beginning of something. I sense it.
That's great. Thank you, Bijan. Yes. Beautiful. And Bijan's calling in from Germany right now. It's, you know, it's really interesting, I think, what's coming up with this role of the role of community and kind of having these kindred people that say you're not crazy to think in these ways. And then there's also this kind of element of trust in the mystery that Bill and Bijan kind of drew upon of, and Jane mentioning, you know, I actually realized I don't have to know the answers and to just be able to hold that and walk into that unknown moment to moment, day by day, like Bijan is describing that he's experiencing right now. And I think there's a lot of beauty to that. And it's also very frustrating, right? Because we're so used to saying, what is your business model? Or what is the plan? How is this going to sustain? This is how it's all going to work out. And from what I'm hearing from each of you who have shared so far is, you know, there is no answer. And there can be plans, but we're uncertain. but there's something fulfilling in the soul. And so that's very vague in a way for, you know, if you want an equation. But it's just kind of, I don't know, interesting how this surfaces up. We have about 20, 25 minutes left in this call. And I don't know if Colin, you wanted to presence anything or reflect back on anything. Colin's a systems thinker and designer and entrepreneur, and he's done a lot of different things, but lately he's been exploring how to metaphorically build cathedrals around, you know, purpose and meaning in different, with different people, with different groups and different systems. And what does that look like? So I don't know if Colin, you want to share anything that comes up from your experience or what you're hearing from everybody. And then we'll open it up to anyone. I think if you have questions or reflections or, you know, just things, reflections from your own journey and your own experiments that you're kind of grappling with, or questions to follow up on any of what anyone has shared.
Yeah, I guess I'll try to be brief. My impetus really for moving into this direction, as you mentioned, serial entrepreneur, sort of MBA, very business focused, interested in entrepreneurship as a means to supporting underserved communities, but not really ever sort of making sort of the kind of move or impact that I sort of had thought that I would sort of achieve in the outset of that sort of path. And then over the course of the last 20 years, watching sort of the physical evidence of complete environmental collapse begin to sort of rear its head and indicate that the entire system that we're in is driving us to ruin. And thinking to myself, you know, for as much as I'd like to be an operative in this system, this is the reason why I went into business as opposed to philanthropy or to politics, because I figured in this system, how do I make a meaningful impact? I have had to reflect and think, well, maybe this system isn't the right one to be in. And so finding sort of, as Jane sort of initiated, the courage to sort of step outside that system was the question that I started to hold. And in that path a couple years ago was reintroduced to Nipun and then to service space and recognized, oh, here's something that might really be the key. This might really be the way it works. This, we don't know what this is per se, but you know, it's certainly sort of directionally speaking, sort of, it feels authentic and it feels true and it feels like it's headed to a nourishing place as opposed to a consuming and exhausting place for the globe. In very small experiments, the first I had was kind of being hand in hand with a friend of mine who suffers from a chronic fatigue syndrome related condition that leaves her completely flat and just absolutely unable to do anything at all for long periods of time. So she's not able to work and has fallen outside of the social support network for a number of different reasons, you know, her appeals and Social Security disability being sort of rejected and such. And so thinking, how can the system support her? How can she be in a world of gift? And would she, who isn't able to sort of give hours of time would she be able to subsist? I mean, she's kind of an extreme case. And so working at the outlier, looking at the extreme case, really became sort of a test for the theory. And she started a book club with a different group that I'm associated with. And it was interesting. It was totally on a gifted basis. And none of it was actually translating into, you know, her being able to support her Maslow hierarchy based survival needs. And so she lost heart in it, but then learned later that there was a relationship that she had established through that activity that translated into grants that in fact did give her over the last year and a half, 2 years, the difference between her actual income and her daily needs. You know, it bridged that gap for her. And so in the way that Nipun and Audrey like to say, you know, there's value everywhere and it can come from unexpected directions when it sort of circles back in, you know, that's it was a fascinating experiment for her and for me as a witness to see that there's not necessarily a direct one-to-one, do this input and you will get this output, but it somehow kind of sorted itself out. But for danger, she has kind of retreated from that because of her own concerns about, I can't engage in magical thinking. I can't just let that be. And, you know, as I watch from a distance, I sort of think to myself, well, maybe not, but maybe so. I mean, maybe that really would have been the key. Keep it up, keep it going. She's now doing some experiments in sort of priceless pricing with something else that she's working on that fits within her scope. Audrey's sort of framing, you know, we can't move beyond the pace of our conditions, I think, has been such a magical phrase because it really has helped me see what Bill last year advised, which is, you know, consider a hybrid method. In my own world, I've done consulting and given it on a free basis. And I have those who are so completely bewildered by what that means that they just don't do anything at all. And it's like, and I find myself sort of thinking, I can do this with them. I can continue, but I actually need to serve my own sort of base needs as well. So I don't know that I have found in this particular individual the fertile field to sort of cultivate this sort of relationship of gift ecology. But in other cases where I've worked sort of on a gifted basis, the resources have circulated back to me from that direct source, not necessarily meeting my expenses, but it does sort of certainly prove the point that that, as Joe pointed out in our laddership through a Marshall Rosenberg post that he made a couple weeks ago, you know, that kind of never charged for anything could actually be a practical approach to sort of living in the world, given that, yeah, maybe it won't come back sort of immediately from that person, but it might come back from some other place. Or in summary, I think I sort of concluded that my thinking at this very moment is to find sufficiency, a la Bill's sort of suggestion of hybrid, find a place of sufficiency and then give all that I've got from there. And, you know, whatever else sort of unfolds is great. And if not, then find a way to have a lifestyle that is completely content with no income whatsoever. And if I did that, then I wouldn't ever need or expect anyone to sort of return anything to me. And I could be in purest heart in all of my service. So those have been my two current thoughts. And I'm inspired to hear of other people's experience. And Parag, thank you so much for your making the point of, you know, the how invaluable community is in this entire experiment. You know, really, I think very resonant for me.
Thank you, Colin. it's great, and it's an interesting question that you raise around kind of, I think Sally Ann mentioned this in her question too, like how do you engage it with these market economy forces while still kind of wanting to hold a heart of gift. And it's, there's no one size fits all answer to that. And also like, what are we willing to give up? I think Joe had brought this up in one of our circles of, you know, like, what am I willing to give up in order to live in a different lifestyle, and what am I not willing to give up? And yeah, what are the pace? What is the pace of our condition? Great. I think we have about 15 minutes left. Lucas, I don't know if you wanted to add any other pile on any questions, or if we want to open it up for anyone here who has questions or reflections, or would like to share from your own experiences. Because although these are our volunteers and they're speaking, everyone actually in this space is at is holding these questions in a unique context. And so there's a lot to learn from that, regardless of life experience and location and everything. It's all, there's so much value in all of it. So Lucas, and then I see Sally Ann has her hand raised.
Yeah, no, I would like to make it short, because for me, the most importance is that people with experience are speaking here. I think what is bugging us here a lot, and we are here also in a system which developed in another system, Buddhist context and things, and you know, they brought up a lot of stuff here. But we see that there are a lot of challenges in bringing up a world of entrepreneurship and paid work, and there are some gaps which are really not working well in terms of efficiency, in terms of durability or sustainability, and in terms of reliance as well. And it seems this is something maybe we can develop, or we need to develop in the real context of our field, as we are hearing that from every one of you. So it's obviously true. And I can sense that also when you go into this field of trust. At the same time, I would be happy to share much more time with you people, because it is actually this real working cases which give this kind of trust. And it takes you on this, I feel that like that, you know, it takes me on this journey. I say, that's how Dr. V did it. And then the idea comes. It's, to me, that's how I learn. So I'm very happy that you shared this time. And if there's no other question, my question would be, how do you work with money in this relation of paid work and unpaid work? This is really, and for yourself too. I mean, I have to pay some bills. I have three children and so. So I, you know, the fact that I can live at the moment is just that my parents died. That's all. That's how I can invest in this project since 2 years. But if this was never, you know, but this ending, it's an ending story, and there's something has to need to happen. That's my story, short.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. And thank you for the reminder of too, like how much we can learn from each other's experiences and experiments. I think Sally Ann, you had your hand raised, and maybe if other people have questions, we can pile on all the questions. And then maybe hear from anyone who wants to answer them. So Sally Ann.
Mine was a question, but I'd first of all like to say thank you, because I've learned so much from hearing real stories and how you've practically done this in the real world. Mine was a question for everyone, but especially for Bill, because we had our homework this week and I was so inspired to hear about Aravind, and it was just one of the pieces that resonated so much with me. And so given our homework, my thoughts and questions are around how important this week's topic of scale was to Aravind at the start, and also that balance between plan and execute and search and amplify. It's one that I'm always asking myself as I'm trying to roll out mine. And when one looks at how measurable it was, the number of people who you've saved their sight and changed their lives, it felt so measurable but so scalable. And yet this week we were discussing scale and depth versus breadth, and last week plan and execute versus search and amplify. So for me, it would be really interesting if we've time to just hear a few thoughts around that.
That's great. I think Alan had one more question also. Oh, no, Ellen is just saying, yes, me too. I want to hear that too. Okay, maybe we can go to Bill, since I think Bill has another commitment shortly, so he might disappear. Bill.
Yes. I would say I can't really speak for Dr. V, because he truly was a visionary, and in his life before retirement, before the Aravind system, he was very much involved with bringing healthcare to the periphery, to the under and unserved. But it wasn't a driving force to scale. But what has happened, and what happened, because they do, in round numbers, 50% of the work they do is free. The patient gets to choose if they want to pay for it or not. But the system functions on the paying clientele. But if they get too many paying clientele, they can't serve the volume of underserved that need to be served. But if they get too many underserved, they can't function in the way they need to. And I'm gonna give an example. I don't know if any of you know around cataract surgery, which is the primary thing that they do, because Dr. V's goal was eliminate needless blindness. And cataract surgery can do that. But in the 90s, intraocular lenses became the cutting edge, so to speak, of cataract surgery. But he did not want to pay the price of manufacturing intraocular lenses, because they cost hundreds of dollars here in the States. And yet his surgical staff said, if we aren't doing intraocular lenses, we're going to be left behind. There's nowhere we can claim to be the best, the highest quality, the greatest safety, etc. So ultimately he said, okay, we have to move forward with intraocular lenses. And this was a gigantic obstacle. But what they wound up doing is negotiating with two U.S. companies that made intraocular lenses to provide them the technical information so Aravind could build its own intraocular lens factory, in essence. And that was an amazing breakthrough for Aravind, because it put them really on, this is the way it needs to be. And as long as they had something around 50% of paying and non-paying clients, they could make it. And as they did that, they attracted, as everybody has already pointed out, sources that they weren't really expecting, but which helped them bridge, because their revenue was quite flat at first, and then it took off. And they still do not use the money that the Oro Lab generates on patient care, because they want their patient care to be completely self-sufficient, self-sustaining. And they still give half of it away. So if that's your concept of scale, then they do scale. And now they have kind of 10 major hospitals, I think now 75 community clinics around the country, and they do literally millions of outpatient visits a year, and hundreds and hundred thousands of cases to international standards. And that wasn't their goal in the beginning, but their work was so alluring. And it was also accompanied by personal principles of functioning, which for him were aspiration. He wanted you to go get the highest possible worth out of what you're doing. Go to your, chase your dream, do the work, the money will follow. And he also stressed what he called skillful rejection, which means not just saying yes to everything, but saying no when it's not the right thing. And I mean, and his third thing was surrender. And for this is his personal side, but surrender not in the sense of giving up, but in surrender of giving into what the mystery is asking us for. So I know that's not quite scalability, but there's room for scaling there, but it's a means to an end. It's not the end goal. And that's really critical, especially in my pathway in the States, where the finances are totally different than they are in India. It was a whole different game that we had to play. And at the same time, we had to fulfill our highest aspiration, which wasn't always connected to financial success. But now the Institute for Health and Healing has succeeded to the point where it's been subsumed by Sutter Health. So it's no longer called the Institute for Health and Healing at California Pacific Medical Center. It's called the Sutter Health Institute for Health and Healing. And it's spreading all over the system. And
you took yourself out of a job.
Exactly.
That's great.
And we knew that. We knew that from the get-go, that if we succeeded, we'd pretty much eliminate ourselves because the major entity would own it. And at the same time now, though, it's financially sustainable. So go figure.
The Sutter Health or the...
Both.
I guess both. That's true.
But I think about the Institute for Health and Healing specifically.
Yeah.
And there were times when they turned off the sprocket for us and we had to find a different way to sustain ourselves. But something always came up. And I don't know
why. How did you get through those times or what like?
Well, a good bit came from initially the startup money came from the California Pacific Medical Center's President's Fund, and then it was matched by the money from the Philanthropic Foundation at the Medical Center. But it didn't follow quite that neatly. It came because the Medical Center was, we can't afford to do this anymore, so we're going to cut you guys free. And the foundation said, the public will not stand for this. You can't do this. This is the most popular program at the Medical Center. And they took us under their wing. And then ultimately we wound up under the wing of the medical foundation. So all our docs and all our practitioners, the acupuncturists, the educators, the Tai Chi teachers, the massage therapists, were all under the auspices of the medical foundation. So our stock went up when they pulled the rug out from under us. And we wound up with support greater than we had before, and much easier access to the pathways that were actually doing the medical work. And I don't know how we did that. I don't think Dr. V really knew. I mean, if you talk to Tulsi, the kind of the lead administrator at Aravind, they didn't have a business plan to start with. They just pawned the family jewels and built the first floor of what has turned out to be the largest eye care system in the world. Yeah. So go figure.
I think it also raises a great question. I know we just have a few minutes left, but I remember hearing a story of Dr. V when in the early days when it was just, you know, 11-bed clinic in his home, and someone came to see him, and at the end they just started, you know, he did a surgery for them. At the end they just started chatting. And the man that was there that had received the treatment said, okay, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you so much for the surgery. Can you tell me how much I owe you? Because I actually have to get going. And at that time, they were pawning the family jewelry to make ends meet.
Right.
And he just looked at him and he said, he just laughed. And he said, your fee is to bring me 10 more people to do this treatment for. And so even in that time of such scarcity, material scarcity, you know, to be able to still, you know, give and to trust, you know, in that, and to see the potential that lies in that exchange. And in living by those values. You know, there's no easy answer. Like Colin said, we have to kind of work at the pace of our conditions. We don't, you know, what works for Dr. V is also because he's Dr. V. What works for Audrey might be very different. What works for Bill, Bija, Jane, Colin, Lucas. Yeah, all of us is going to be different.
That's absolutely true. And the generation, there's a generational difference now too, because the young people who are taking over have a totally different experience than the elders who started this work, and it's a whole different arena that's being played right now.
Yeah,
and very powerful to see these young kids, because they're great doctors, but their experience is so totally different from their parents. Mm. And now the young folks are running the show.
Yeah, it's great. I know Joe had his hand up, and Parag also had a story of a success and a failure. That's very juicy that's very teasing, but we have 1 minute left. So I think I'm going to invite Joe to ask his question. Maybe we can do a minute of silence if anyone really needs to go, or if anyone needs to go, you're welcome. This is optional. We're not holding you hostage. This is a 90-minute commitment. So if anyone needs to go, you can. But for those who want to stay to just hear a couple more stories, you're welcome to after that. So Joe, do you want to present your question, and then we can go to a minute of silence and then Prag?
Yes, I was encouraged by Colin mentioning something that he found inspirational, and so did I, and I thought I would share it, and it has to do with money, and but you know, I think maybe I'll put it on the feed after the circle. It has to do with Marshall Rosenberg, and I found it so transformational, and it came up a week and a half ago in our laddership circle, so I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, that's such a tease, but maybe you can share a tidbit with us, but I just want to be mindful of honoring everyone's time, so if anyone needs to go, maybe we can just do a minute of silence just to kind of bookend that, and then maybe folks can stay maybe 10-15 minutes extra. We can kind of finish up a few of the stories that we've been teased with. But yeah, so I think it's really beautiful to just kind of hear so much. I mean, I feel like there's so much that has surfaced, and I'm glad that we have Wednesdays, a breakout also, to dive into some of the nitty gritty around this. But it's just a real honor to be in the space together where none of us really have specific answers to these really non-easy questions in a way. And we're all in different contexts, you know, whether you're in disaster resiliency or business or medicine or the arts or peace building or the NGO world or media or law, like there's and finance, like in all different fields, like how can we bring this labor of love, how can we bring a spirit of service and inner transformation, and what does that form look like for these formless values, and what wants to surface from there, and who is actually the one doing it. I think there's that element of surrendering, there's the element of not knowing that Jane touched upon, of the mystery that Bill and Bijan mentioned, of relying on the strength of the relationships that you're part of, you know, in the community, and surrendering to that. And then also at just, you know, nature's pace, you know, what are the pace of our conditions that Colin mentioned. So thank you all so much for kind of gathering for this conversation, and we'll just do a minute of silence just to close for all the goodness that's been shared. And then for those who want to stay for a bonus section, we can stay on for maybe 10-15 more minutes after that. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And good to see Stephanie, who is up working late last night. Not sure if she would make it on this early morning call. So I'm glad you made it. I think for those who want to continue the conversation, Parag actually had a story to share. Maybe Joe, you could share a tidbit you want. And also Lucas, if you had anything to add or to mention, since you are the inspiration behind all of us convening here today. So Parag, why don't you go for it?
One quick story where we had a grand success with a River of Love project. We also had a failure. As I analyzed that, what was the dividing line between the success and failure? So in Surat, we host Karma Kitchen for last 3.5 years, some 35-40 Karma Kitchen, last Sunday of every month. Three, four things are constant in that Karma Kitchen, that it is fully sold out. We run on Sunday morning, so it is fully sold out. At least 30-40% people would sign up to volunteer again for the next Karma Kitchen. So that's also one lead indicator that how much people are moved by that. So we will get enough volunteers to cook and do all sorts of service. And though money is not important, but I would say it was an embarrassing cash flow. We have so much money, you know, we can host Karma Kitchen in so many places. Even I don't know. We would always get 2 or 3 times our cost. Typically, a restaurant, the most cost is about the people, but because we are all volunteers, so we will save on that. So I would say Karma Kitchen in Surat, probably every time we would feed at least 100, 110 people on an average. And it was, you know, that's a great labor of love project. So many people got connected. You know, the community itself of volunteer is now 220 people who is on our volunteer list for Karma Kitchen and the guest list. So that's one, I would say something what I aspire to look at it. And I would term it reasonable success in terms of not monetary success, but in terms of the whole experiment. And on the opposite end of the spectrum, you know, I started, you know, I am a founder of a school in Surat, a very high-end IB private school in Surat, one of the top schools probably in the area, not just in the city. And 4 times a year, there would be a book fair. This is a typical thing happening with Indian schools where there would be a book fair where all peripheral books for children, meaningful storybooks, meaningful novels, would be sold and parents would come and buy. That's typically 3 or 4 times a year we would have a book fair for students and parents. And I thought of, let's do it on a gift basis. Just this bookstore, let's run this bookstore on a gift basis. And we did run it for 2 years. But it was a cold affair, to be honest. Monetarily, we didn't lose much, maybe 10-15% over 4 years. It's not a big sum for a school. On just books, but it didn't create much ripple, and the shelf life was limited, so it died on its own. And if there was not much enthusiasm, I didn't thought to push it down the throat of school academic and administrative team that let's do it. I did start it. It did pick up, and it lost its way. And as I sit back and reflect, what is the difference between these two? I think the key difference is. How do you share the context? If you are, a labor of love project is a love project. It's not just exchange of goods and services on free basis. If you are not able to touch people's heart, or if you are not able to communicate love or, the context around the whole affair, I think it died down. That's what I realized. While if you look at the Karma Kitchen, the design is such that every moment people, if you are coming as a guest, the way you are welcomed, the way you sit down, the way people are serving, and the whole experience, every moment he says, oh man, oh this is amazing, oh this is amazing. Every moment, everything is amazing for them. And not in terms of that we had some fantastic food or a fantastic menu, but it was made with love. I think the key ingredient missing, running a bookstore just from a, was just a material thing which got exchanged without the context, that is love, and it died down. Well, I think this survived and flourished and grew at its own pace. Thank you. Just to share the two differences, what I experienced.
That's great. Yeah, I think that's, yeah. There's, you know, I think in a market economy too, we're so primed to just look at value as material things and the exchange of commodities. And when you step into kind of a circle of gift, you know, or a gift ecology, there's no definable, I get for this input or for this output, I get this in return or this input in return, right? It's non-transferable in a way. But that's an amazing question. How do you hold that context of love and nurture that?
And that is the key ingredient. You know, if anything is missing and if we are not able to get hold of it, probably how to share that context of love is the greatest challenge, not how to sustain it. If there is enough love, sustenance is a very small part of the whole story. I think that's the key challenge, if you ask me. From my lens, that's what I see.
Yeah. I think Jane has her hand up. Yes. Jane has her hand up. And then I wonder if anyone in our Injaski, Olivier or Patrick, want to share anything. Because when I think of a context of love, I feel like what the three of you are kind of cultivating in France is that context of love in a way, just from all the experiments that you've been up to. So maybe after Jane, if anything comes up to share, it would be great to hear from your experiences.
Yeah, I just wanted to just kind of firstly acknowledge that distinction that Parag has brought there. I just think it's such an important insight, is the context. And the context in which love can be communicated, or it can be the leading principle. And we found when we're doing our kindness capital experiments, one of the interesting things, and it's similar, you know, whenever we were kind of speaking to children in some of the private schools in the area, it was very hit and miss because there wasn't a particular, they had no particular context for it. It's like, well, if I want something, I could just go and buy it. So, you know, what would be the point? So putting the kind of onus on to the individual who's being involved, that if, you know, it's your acts of kindness, you go out and do them in the context of your life and your world. And for us, the exchange is that, you know, we're trusting that you're involving yourself in this, that's the exchange. We're not evaluating your acts of kindness or how valuable they are. And that allows people some sense of autonomy about how creates the circumstances in which they can lead with love in their life. But I think connecting that then to the question about this balance of, you know, money and the, you know, the question that Lucas is raising is like, you know, how do you do that? I really do think it is all about context. There are certain contexts in which a gift ecology will flourish, and there are certain contexts in which it won't. And one of the contexts in which it won't is if the individual, the leader, is so stressed as a result of kind of financial pressure, then there's no room for anything to take root or to flourish, I think, in those circumstances. And I've learned that really, you know, the kind of the hard way. So I think that, you know, context is such an important point, and the ability to discern, you know, in the moment. And it's a moment by moment thing about when that comes up. So yeah, I just wanted to add
No, that's beautiful. It's really true. And yeah. And also, Jane, it would be great actually if you could speak briefly on the kindness, what your experiments around like incorporating kindness capital in your peacekeeping.
Yes, because
yeah. So concretely, because not, I don't even fully, I think it's constantly evolving, so none of us really know.
So the idea, so multiple forms of, I mean, value, what we mean by value is absolutely a passion of mine. This is central to all aspects of my life, because I think in that is all mystery, is all meaning, is really, is in what we mean by value. And obviously having been in that position where, you know, I was in that very reductive lens of, and you know, things are only valuable if you can measure them in money, and the most amount of money is the most valuable. So my question then is how, you know, in order for us to thrive, I think as a collective, as humanity, we have to extend our understanding of value and what that could mean. And I wanted to do that in the context of Peacebeam. And, you know, I looked at kind of, well, could you introduce the idea of multiple forms of capital because there are so many? And then really it just came down to these are very hard concepts to communicate to people who are very used to a market economy, right? So I think that's the first thing to be clear about that. And, you know, and it's not going to land for a lot of people because this is very, it's, you know, this is, let's say that we're very ahead of our time, I hope, right? So we settled on kindness capital, and that was the idea, and it was linked to some people do the, you know, the unticket idea that, you know, you could give something of, you know, alternative value in exchange for a ticket. So we decided that it would be kindness capital. We produce audios, guided meditations. We do them for children and for adults. And that you could buy that with money, or if you wanted to pay with kindness capital, that you would go out and do your 7 acts of kindness, and then you would write to us and tell them about it. And we are trusting that you're engaging, you know, I mean, we're not going to verify that. We can't verify it. The fact that you're participating, we're assuming, you know, you're telling us the truth. And then we give you a code, and you apply the code, and then it's, we treat it as currency. So that's what we're doing at the moment. And we tested it with children between 6 and 11, and they're incredibly engaged. They think it's fantastic. Children between 11 and 18, trickier. It's harder to get them engaged. It's harder to get attention. Most people between about 20 and 35 will think that's such a lovely idea, but here's the money. And then people kind of from 50 onwards, there is another, I don't know why that is, but there is a bigger embrace of that kind of form of exchange. So that's what we're doing, but we're in the middle of the experiment at the moment. So, and the idea is just to hold the question and see, like, you know, where does this land? Yeah.
And when you test it, you mean just like introducing this and seeing how people respond, or?
Yes. Well, we've asked from our community. We gathered various different kind of test groups, and we asked people to just go through the process. There were kind of unlinked web pages that you go through, and then we ask questions at the end of it. So we have some qualitative and quantitative data coming through as well. So I can I'll post up the I'll post up where you. I mean, if anybody's interested, you can go through and, you know, give your feedback. So yeah.
That would be great. Yeah, it's great because and Coleman, who's on this call, I think I told you about his conference that where they did untickets last summer, and that was a beautiful experiment also. I'm always looking at the clock, but wanted to invite our French gang if anything surfaces for you around this context of love that Parag mentioned. And then Joe, I know I saw your hand up, and Lucas, is there anything you wanted to respond with right now or in general?
No, I think I'm super happy with what was possible. And I'm full of, how to say, gratitude that this was happening now. And my wish, my quest is that it continues, you know, because what I just noticed is this, for me, forming in our circle a gift economy concept really is nurtured by very practical experiences, like the last one we heard from Jane. This I can relate. This is just building in me, and then I can relate to it. And when we have a similar question, how can we do that? So I'm very grateful for really this kind of practical exchange, you know, versus the whole question of holding space, bringing this kind of inner part into it, which is the startup. That's clear. This is what we heard the whole time. And still, this is really nurturing what you gave to us, and I wish it could continue. This is my quest.
That's great. Thank you. So from our French gang, was it Olivier? Did you have your hand up? Are you the spokesperson?
Yeah, I had it because I don't know. I had so much inspiration thanks to you, to your speeches and remarks, and also latest thoughts that I had is around the experimentation. Jane has explained it in her way. Others have also exposed their way to do experimentation, and I think it's something that surfaced to me several. Lately, I would say that, of course, a lot of is coming from a heart and a lot of coming from the head. But how to put that with the hands, actually. And it's really a question that I try to do, let's say, a bit every day, just to try and to make some experiment. Like, for example, that at the office, I like to do some experiment to interact with people. Let's say, for instance, if one colleague of mine is thinking very like negatively and is disturbing everyone else. One day I was in this discussion where everyone was very negative, and especially one guy who when I listened to him, I was drawn and sucked with his negativity. And suddenly I had this mind, okay, no, don't go with him in this negativity and just switch your mind. And I took a piece of paper, you know, and I wrote on this piece of paper 1, 2, and 3. And at the top of the piece of paper, I wrote gratitude. And I handed him this sheet of paper and told him, okay, yeah, I cannot listen to you now because I have more interesting things to do, but also because you are too negative. And so I would like you to just consider this piece of paper and fill the 1, 2, and 3 with good things that you think during your day. And at the end of the day, don't leave the office before handing me this sheet to me. And so he went back to his desk. I think he went back to work and stopped complaining. And at the end of the day, he came to my desk very like with a smile, and he gave me his sheet back with not only 3 but 5 gratitudes, like 5 lines of positive things that he talked about that day. And that were very simple thoughts, like I spoke with my manager and he was happy, or I did this thing, I called this guy. It was really like simple things, but I saw that he went out of the office very like content, happy, and he lost his negativity. And so that, I think, this kind of experiment, I don't know, it was very spontaneous, but I guess it's a good practice, right?
Well, I think what you raised too is just, you know, on one side of it, there's the designing for inner transformation, and the other side is the actual practice of inner transformation, the actual embodiment of it.
That's really, it's what can you do with your hands? I mean, how can you translate your heart and what you are thinking with your head, with your hands? You know, maybe they don't speak the same language, but that's really what I tried to do lately. And and also one thing that maybe you can know or not, but I will change my job within 6 weeks. And so one by one, I'm talking to my colleagues and I tell them, okay, I'm going to leave this company. So maybe that's the last time we're talking about together. And everyone had got so deep feedbacks of our relationships, our connections to each other. Everyone told to me, you're going to be missed, not only because you are working well, but also because you are human. And so if I had a message or a holding question, it's really to push people to be very human, even at work and where they are, to be themselves and not only to be numbers in a company.
Yeah, right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. And I just am very inspired by that, because I think in that spirit that you guys have been hosting a lot of different events and gatherings and just nurturing that spirit with your community. So I feel like...
Yeah, I guess. Maybe, I don't know, maybe perhaps you can take over. But yeah, there's a lot of things happening in France. So really grateful for that.
Yeah. I think just for time, since I know we're way over my 10, 15 minutes now, I think Bijan just had maybe something to share. And then I think if anyone who hasn't spoken yet wants to just share any closing thoughts or anything brief, we can, and we'll close in a couple minutes from there.
Yeah, thank you, Audrey. I just wanted to put an invitation out to our group. It's been, every time I come to a laddership circle and to this breakout, it feels like you're in a watering hole and you're nourishing, you know, you're getting more alignment and you don't feel as alone. But each one of these projects that we're working on have their own unique conditions and creative constraints. So I was wondering if we could, on the feed, dive deeper on some of these questions that we might be holding. For me in particular, you know, one of the questions we start on is danger points. What you are some of the danger points? And when you feel things are going faster than the pace at which you're comfortable moving, I sense danger. And that's kind of the nature of this pandemic and what it brings, opportunities that it's opening for us and ways we can react to that. So I would love to think collectively with all of you or those who are interested around some of these questions. For example, just in a parenthesis, we have come up with structure now with Phuket, you know, the destination in Thailand, the hotel association there, to provide all their certifications as sort of an exchange for them to translate our content into Thai. So that's one mechanism by which it works with this destination to do this. But at some point, it takes resources from us to do the certification. So this might not be sustainable in the long run with other places. So around questions like that, I would love to pick your brains and see, you know, what could work, what you would say maybe a danger or anyway, that would be nice to collectively think through these problems with you.
That's great. Yeah, maybe we can set something up online so we can continue this dialogue further. I'm mindful that now we're a bit over, so I think this is kind of a good time to bookmark this. But I wanted to give voice. Is there anyone that has any burning thoughts, burning last thoughts or reflections, or just a comment to share? Just in closing. Yeah, Colin.
When I first came to Service Space, I was very hungry for case studies, and all of this experience around this particular circle is a confirmation. That hunger died a little bit, but it's a confirmation that the hunger is resident amongst us all, and that this feed, as Bijan, you've suggested, is a great idea. Maybe, you know, even sort of collectively as a group effort, we set out to kind of document what we know so far. Because I think that as a resource, it will be really very empowering for not just us, but anyone who should come behind us and perhaps allow sort of those seeds or those spot fires to spring up in more places more easily.
Mm.
So just put that out there and we can sort of figure out the logistics of that on the
feed. Yeah. Well, you know, we have a Laddership alumni feed that actually I think all of you are part of, even though the circle's not over yet. So that could be a space to explore this, because there's also a lot of people that couldn't make this conversation that would have a lot to add also.
Absolutely. That'd be great.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any last thoughts? Coleman, David, Alan, Stephanie, Jasky? Asha?
Well, I did have a question, but I hate putting anyone on the spot. I wanted Audrey to answer it, actually, when you put your three ABC questions there. Could you could you, because I'd be curious to know the danger points. As someone who does live in that pure surrender, what are the danger points? So could you answer? Sorry for putting you on the spot.
The danger, what have, okay.
Well, the, what yeah. Have the most
okay, and then we'll close with that. Maybe I... oh, shit.
Sorry, but you asked.
No, it's okay. It's great. I'm always happy to be put on the spot. I'm trained now to be put on the spot. I think the most dangerous moments in my journey, it's actually, I think the most dangerous moments in my journey have been when I've succumbed to fear. And acted from a space of fear rather than love. So I think it's just really interesting to see how the more we let go of our expectation of the systems around us, there's a sense of kind of, I don't know, like there's a sense of maybe equanimity, I don't feel like I'm a quantumist, but Parag has this analogy of the ROEs. He had to step off for another event, but he says, you know, when I first became an entrepreneur, I was very focused on my return on equity and, you know, what am I making from the investment that I'm putting into it? Then he said he founded the school and he became a philanthropist. And he said, now I'm focused on my, then I realized, you know, I started the school, I was doing service in the community, but it was actually a return on my ego. Like I wanted to feel good about what I was doing. and then he talked about, you know, his experiences in the last maybe 6-7 years of really trying to deepen in his service journey. And he said, the more I deepen in this, the more I realize it's really the greatest return is the return on equanimity. The return that I get from just, there are great things that happen, there are not so great things that happen, but to just ride it all through with that understanding of impermanence. And that's, you know, the returns on that, being able to weather any storms that come up are the most magnificent. And I think in my journey with dangerous moments, it's, you know, it's funny because I've had moments where, you know, I think one of the most powerful moments would be like a heartbreaking one when my father died. And I was like, so I had just come off a meditation retreat the week before. So I was like very like in this whole impermanence space. And so when he passed, I just felt buoyed by the community around. But I mean, there were just like this outpouring of love. Like someone tagged me with a plane ticket to fly to my mom's house. And then, you know, people did acts of kindness and dedicated it to my dad. And strangers wrote into me telling me an act of kindness that they did and that they dedicated on his behalf. And so there's this like feeling of like physical loss of a parent. And then this, on the flip side, just this knowing that there's this greater scheme at play and I don't know what's good or what's bad. I can't even begin to say that, you know, what I expect or what I envision or what I want is what is needed to happen. It's really, there's just a greater flow that's unfolding and I don't know what it is, but hopefully I can have a little bit of clarity or support from the community clarity to know what steps to take forward. So I think those are the moments that have been powerful and the dangerous ones have been the ones where I haven't listened to that and where I've said, no, I'm actually afraid, so I'm just gonna do this. and they're not that dangerous. I mean, it's all good. But I've seen that those are the moments where I feel like I just, my organizing principle changes and so different results happen. So that's I think all I say. Hollister's battery is on 0%. So I think maybe with that we can close and just say hugs goodbye and thank you all for staying on and for this amazing conversation. and maybe I'll unmute you all so we can just do a. We already did our minute of silence, but we can just do a goodbye, good night, good morning.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Notes on all your stuff.